and gentlemen, welcome wrestling fans worldwide to Knoxville and the Great Smoky Mountains for the Ron Fuller Tennessee Studcast.
6 feet 9 inches tall, 265 pounds.
This historic podcast from one of the most respected and successful wrestlers and promoters will follow the footsteps of one of the largest and oldest wrestling families on the planet.
The Tennessee Stud, Ron Fuller.
Through 93 years and four generations.
The Stud has arrived.
Old school or new fan, this unique broadcast will educate and captivate as Ron details decades of professional wrestling's growth with truly unforgettable stories.
I want those people out there at home to hear the Stud.
Sit back and enjoy the ride with the Tennessee Stud.
The Tennessee Stud. You will learn that name. You will remember it.
And now,
the Stud is here.
Please welcome the creator of the popular 605 podcast and the president of the Arcadian Vanguard Podcast Network, your co-host, the great Ryan Last.
Hello again, friends, and thank you for joining us today for a very special 100th episode of Ron Fuller's Studcast. Today's show is special in two ways. It is the first ever 1.5 hour regular Studcast, and it is also a Welch family reunion with Ron, Robert, and Jimmy Golden all live together right here on the Studcast for the very first time. Very much akin to the Super Studcast. And before we get going any further, real quick, I want to remind everyone that Super Studcast number 18 with Fists of Stone, Ronnie Garvin. I'm sure he will come up later in the show when we talk about the Knoxville Wrestling War. But part one is up now, where the Tennessee Stud and Ronnie Garvin sit down and talk about his entire career from beginning to end. I guess he's still around wrestling, but no longer an active wrestler. Get to hear about everything we touch on Knoxville, but get ready because part two is going to talk all about the Knoxville Wrestling War. You can get these shows at patreon.com/studcast or tnstud.com. They're only $2.99 to get you in the door. We'll have more information about them later on in the show. But right now, let's start the celebration of 100 Studcasts, 100 episodes of the Studcast that have fascinated wrestling fans all around the world and introducing the story of the world's oldest and largest wrestling family, the Welches. And of course, today we have three members with us live. And let's start with the introduction of the man who brings you the Studcast, the legendary Tennessee Stud himself, Ron Fuller. Ron, congratulations on 100 episodes. How does it feel today?
Jeez, pretty amazing. I tell you that, Brian. Didn't really expect this, it's quite an honor, and I'm humbled by it, to be honest, that they've got enough supporters out there that want to hear my family's history. And I just really, really enjoy doing it and laying it out there. And to get 100 episodes in is really quite a feat. And today, you know, this is a special one, that's for sure. And I'm really, really looking forward to it.
Well, this is usually the part of the show where I ask you this question, but I know we have two great guests standing by right now, one there with you and one on the line. Ron, where are we going today with this special 100th episode of your Studcast?
Well, today we're really going to... first of all, Brian, I'd like to welcome everyone out there that's listening today for their support, their basic support for all Studcasts and obviously Super Studcasts as well. Without you, and I'm talking to our loyal listeners out there, there'd be no reason for this 100th Studcast. And I had no idea almost 2 years ago today, when I did the first Studcast, that I would be here celebrating 100 episodes. So fans worldwide are responsible for the Studcast phenomena, and it has become a part of my life and that I not only enjoy, but I look forward to each week. And this one is a very special one to me for many reasons, but obviously because it is the 100th episode and because it involves my family members that helped my career whenever I needed it and work side by side with me to develop territories that are still remembered and revered today. I want to thank both my guests and welcome them to the regular Studcast for the first time. And Also thank them for their own great Super Stud cast that they've helped make those 3-hour shows so successful by doing those Super Stud casts with me. And so Brian, on behalf of both of us, I'd like to introduce my brother Robert Fuller and my cousin Jimmy Golden. And Rob, thanks for being here. And Jimmy, same here.
Well, you know what, Ron? I'm not surprised very much that you made this 100th. You know, that's 100 times that you've come out here and had successful talks with the folks out there at home. And I'm not terribly surprised, being you're so full of shit anyway.
Well, that's a good way to start it.
You know, you got me over here, man. Other than $1,000 you're paying me, I guess, doggone it, that you know, I ought to get my 2 cents in. How about you, Jimmy?
Man, that's going to be hard to beat that, man. That's pretty good there, Stud. I was talking to Robert there. You know, I was going to tell all the fans out there, I know which one's the true Stud, but I can't tell you. Y'all going to have to figure that out yourself.
Well, I got so many names, Jimmy, I'll give that one up. I don't even care. Hot dog it, man. It's not worth the war anymore. I said, what the heck? I stick with Colonel Parker and make more money that way anyway. So whatever.
Huh? I hear you.
So for today, Brian, I thought we would just, we're just going to have some fun here today. We're going to have an hour and a half, which, we've never done that before on a regular studcast. We've never had live guests except for one program, for a regular studcast. And, this one is a special one. And, you know, and if you don't mind, Brian, I'm just going to jump right in, man, because I got a few questions I want to ask, and I have a little direction I'd like to point us in. You know, I started these studcasts talking about all the way back to my grandfather, Roy, and gosh, we've had, the three of us, fabulous experiences with Roy, and, you know, and some not so fabulous experiences with Roy. But I'd like to start off today, since they've already jumped on my butt. I want to give you an idea of what my brother and my cousin were like as young boys, about 7 or 8 years old. And on my granddad's farm, he had a huge farm, big dairy, and they had this gas tank. It must have been a 200-gallon gas tank. It was probably 15 feet long, maybe 5 feet across, 6 feet, good 5 or 6 feet tall. And, it had a big, round thing that you spun off the top of it to be able to suck the gas out of the tank. And I'm 8 years old. I'm the oldest one of the three. Rob's about 7. Jimmy's in that range of around 6 in that time frame. And I'm off playing, doing something on my own. And I come back by the gas tank on my way to the house. And I see my brother laying on his belly on one side of the tank and Jimmy laying on his belly on the opposite side of the tank, and both of their noses stuffed down into the hole sniffing gasoline.
I'm going to hang up on you, Ron.
You know something, Jimmy? He don't know, man. We graduated from lawnmowers to get to there. That doggone it. See, he doesn't know about the lawnmowers, but we worked our way up to that big gas tank. After a while, you know, you get a little bit of the good and then you want a little more of it. That, unfortunately, we probably went on with that deal right on through the 80s, certainly the 80s, not snorting gas, but, you know, it can get a lot worse. But anyway, you know, you do some crazy things when you're kids, and thank God that I can be 70 years old, and I think you're just a year younger than me, and not have some of that stuff come back and bite us in the butt. But granddaddy, he had a lot of stuff going on there, you know, that, you have a great big gas tank like that to fill up his, all of his equipment there on the farm. Me and you finding another use for it. That's kind of funny, Ron.
Yeah.
Thanks a lot for that.
Well, you know, I just for Brian and for the fans out there, you know, there's a somewhat a difference between the three of us. And it seems like always the two of y'all were looking for something to get into. So I see him, Brian, to finish my story here, laying belly down on this huge gas tank with their faces stuffed into the hole that you suck the gas out of. And, I say, hey, what are you guys doing? And they barely raise their heads up and their eyes are all funny looking. And they go, you want to come up here? And I go, no, what are you doing, man? Well, we're just smelling of this, you know? And I was like, wow. So I go on to the house and I get my grandma. And I go, maybe you ought to come out here and see this. And Jimmy's mom is there too. And so they both march with me back out to the gas tank, and they start on Rob and Jimmy, man. They're not too happy with it. Obviously, they get themselves their butts torn up a little bit. But it's just a kind of a right off the bat, we set the tone of where I am in this particular equation.
You know
where these two are.
You know what it set the tone to? It set the tone to my brother being the big damn stooge. That's what they call him in the business. Jimmy, you know what a stooge is, don't you? Hot dog, man, they had the worst name in all of the business was the guy going around stooging all the time. He started stooging before he was 10 years old, didn't he, Jimmy?
Yeah, he's a squealer, man. I was going to tell you that's the reason that I'm so smart today, sniffing that gasoline. I've been getting a buzz all my life. Ended up quitting the gasoline because Mama beat the hell out of me that day, and that taught me a big lesson. So as the end of the gasoline,
I stopped gasoline, moved on to something else.
Yeah, I tell you, you know, about another 5-10 minutes of that, guys, and we wouldn't have been having this be a one-way conversation. I don't believe either one of the two of y'all would have survived that. But, you know, we always
had something to talk about, Ron.
Yeah, wouldn't have nothing to talk about. That's for sure. And we would have certainly missed a lot of darn good times together. So I'm glad I stooged on you guys, bottom line, I guess.
Yeah.
Going to tell another story real quick, Jimmy. And this kind of sets the tone for the way things are going to go over the next 70 years is when you come and visit us in Mobile, and where Dad's got Mobile and the Gulf Coast just started cranked up, and you're about 5 years old, I figure, at this time frame, maybe even younger, 4 years old.
No, at least five.
You know, about five, and we're a year or so older than you are. And we're out playing in the yard, and I think Rob's swinging a baseball bat, and you're close to him, and I'm somewhere in that general vicinity, and I remember looking up and you jumping across a little bunch of bushes. And Rob swinging the bat about the same time. He don't see you coming. And you get your first stitches, man. it was like a home run hit with somebody's head.
You know what? It was the worst. It was one of the worst things at that time that ever happened in my life because Jimmy and I were so close. And the fact that you know, it was all an accident, but the fact that I had hit him with the baseball bat and sent him to get stitches. And back then, you know, you're little kids and you don't even know if he's even going to live and everything. And then I got the big high spot the next day when Mom and Dad let me stay out of school because it was Jimmy's last day there. He had the stitches in his eyes. And I got to stay out of school. Remember that, Jim? We played all day.
I'll never forget that day. That was a day to remember there, brother. I don't remember exactly how it happened, but yeah, my first digit. It's for sure. I've been hit in the head a few times. They need to donate my brains to science.
You know, Jimmy, I've often said a lot of times that people have said, hey, you had so many things happen in your life. Why don't you write a book? Why don't you write a book? And just say, oh, I'll write about wrestling. I said, no, no. If I was ever going to write a book, I'd call it Knocked Out, because we've been knocked out so many darn times that I could write a heck of a book about it. And I know you could, too.
Yeah.
So-
Yeah.
I got one more story, guys, and then we're going to talk a little bit about where we are in the Studcast time frame, and a lot further than that in this particular program. I think we're going to have some real fun today. My last story is we're all grown up at this point. In fact, I'm in college at Clemson, and you guys are Rob's and y'all are in McDonough. You're going to school there in McDonough, and you're living with us at this point, Jimmy. And you live with us for about 3 or 4 months, it seems like, during the course of that 1 year. And we've got a basketball goal, and it's nailed to the side of a barn. I mean, we don't have a nice goal, a glass backboard, that type of stuff. All we have is a barn, and we finally figure out how to nail a basketball goal up on the side of the barn, and we start playing ball. But it's always two against one. It's always me against the two of you. And in these basketball games that I remember, I'm not allowed to block your shots. I'm not allowed to drive on you. And I have to shoot from the outside. And so it's a real handicap. I'm not only playing against two guys that are about my same age, but I've got all these rules that just apply to me and none whatsoever to you guys. And I remember one game in particular in which we got right down to the end, and you guys are about to whip me, and y'all start on me, and you're talking that trash, and eventually I have to do something about it to keep from losing.
Yeah, well, what happened? Yeah, he gonna tell a story, Jimmy. Go ahead. He's gonna tell a story here where he was about to lose. And then he did something to save himself. But the real truth is, me and you beat him right there. We won the game, and after we won the little game, oh boy, man! Then he got madder than heck. Now I'll let him finish what he does.
Hey, well, you're right, Jimmy. You know, I just jump up there and I jerk the goal off the side of the barn, and I take it to the house.
So we worked all day to get that goal up there, me and Robert. And then while he comes out, he lost. And then he goes start making a bunch of excuses why he lost. He lost because he lost, and he got pissed off and tore down the goal, man.
You tell him, Jimmy. You tell him you're right on, brother.
Okay. All right. I figure I'll let y'all have a little fun right off the start. And, you know, so what I thought we'd do today, Brian, is kind of get to where we are in the timeline of the Studcast. And we're at episode 100. We're basically about April of 1975. Rob has worked his first show in the Coliseum. It's the third Coliseum show, and he wrestles against Jerry Briscoe on that third Coliseum show. It's his first time ever wrestling for Southeastern. Jimmy's been there in the territory for about 2 months. He's gone through a program with Danny Hodge, which was having a lot of fun for you, no doubt, Jimmy. So, with Danny Hodge, and then in this Coliseum show, he's partners with Seth Thatcher, and they're wrestling against George Barnes and Bill Dundee for the Southern Tag Championships. That's just to bring fans kind of where we are up to date. And, Jimmy, let's just start with you a little bit. You know, it was you'd been in Knoxville before. Rob had also worked in Knoxville a bunch of times. I never worked Knoxville until I actually bought it. So you had some experience with making trips into Knoxville area. And, just to give me a little bit of an impression of that you had with Knoxville and how that thing might be going to work out.
Well, you know, like I said, I came over here for John Kazanis out of Nashville. I was working for Nick and Roy. And we'd make trips to Knoxville and Johnson City for John Kazanis. And, you know, I didn't have get a lot of feel for East Tennessee at that time. until you was here and I moved up here to stay. And that's when I really fell in love with East Tennessee. But, you know, things were just kind of so-so when John was here. Nick and him sending him pallet and trying to help him as much as he could, but it was tough for John. You know, East Tennessee, we fell in love with it. And you know, you got it going, and that's when I fell in love with it. Came up here, you and Robert was here, already wrestling up here, and things just got better and better and better, man.
Yeah. Well, Jimmy, I have some fond memories of old John Kazanis, myself, and times there before Ron had bought that. I got a great story about it that I'll tell you about John Kazanis. That his top guys in there were Whitey Caldwell. You remember Whitey, and Ron Wright, and Ron and Donnie Wright. And they always had the big feud between Ron Wright and Whitey Caldwell and the chain matches and a lot of blood and a lot of stuff going on. But Roy Lee and I, we were working for John Kazanis, and we were working with the Wrights. And he wanted to work into a six-man tag, and the Wright boys had a partner coming in to be their partner, and John had told us that we're going to work this angle in 3 weeks from now, that you and Roy are going to have a big mystery partner. And we asked him, who's the mystery partner? And he said, oh, no, if I tell you, it won't be a mystery. And we're looking at him like, hey, you know, we're one of the boys here. We're not the you keep the mystery to the people, but you let us know what's going on. But that was John Kazanis, and that was the way that he did things. And sure enough, it came the night that we were going to introduce the mystery partner, and John got us back there in the corner, and he hadn't told us yet who the mystery partner is. We're looking around the dressing room, and we're going, now where is the dadgum big deal, the mystery guy coming in? And so John gets me and Roy Lee over there, and he says, all right, well, boys, he said, here's what we're going to do. He said, Roy, you go in there, and you sell, and boy, they're going to get real good heat on you. And he said, then make the tag to Rob. Well, what had happened, the mystery partner was going to be Whitey Caldwell. He just let us know. But Whitey Caldwell had worked there for him for 10 years. So, you know, what's the mystery? He had an old bathrobe that he put on him with a hood up in the front. And the bathrobe came down to his knees. You could see his wrestling boots and all of his stuff. And so I was wondering, that this is the craziest thing I've ever seen. People are going to know who Whitey Caldwell is as soon as he walks out in the bathrobe and with a hood. And he's going to hold the face together so you can't see his face. And John said, well, Roy, you get that heat built up and you tag old Rob, and he's going to jump that top rope and he's going to beat the heck out of everybody in that ring, and he'll leave them all laying flat. And when they're all laying flat, then Rob, you tag Whitey. And I said, that's about the dumbest thing I have ever heard in my entire life, that, you know, that I would be selling and tag him hot and so he can come in and do his thing. But he said, oh, boy, you do this, you watch what happens. So sure enough, boy, Roy got the heat and he gave me the hot tag. And boy, I jumped in there and I just laid everybody out. And when they were all flat, I tagged Whitey. And I'm going to tell you something. Whitey threw the hood off of that dadgum bathrobe he had and jerked the bathrobe off, and the house went crazy. I've never seen anything like it in my life. That's Knoxville. That's the people went crazy. Oh, my God, it's Whitey. And Roy Lee had to look at one another like, now I have never in my entire life seen anything like it. And Whitey went in with the dead bodies and jerked them all up and boom, boom, boom. And the people went nuts. And I had to go back in the dressing room, and me and Roy Lee looked at one another. We said, we don't know anything about this business. John Kazanis is smarter than all of us. So I figured right there, I got a lot of more respect for John Kazanis, because I said, you know what? You've got a handle on these Knoxville people. I've never seen anything like it. But anyway, that was a funny story with the wrestling to be like it was over there until Ron bought it.
It was kind of a crazy place. In fact, guys, we've spent, Brian and I, a lot of time talking about John Cazana's commentator, Big Jim Hess. He's kind of become a big figure here in the Super Stud Cast because of the emphasis that I have put on him and how I saw him. And I just wanted to get you guys' opinion of what you thought about Big Jim Hess.
You know what, Jimmy? I'm surprised Big Jim didn't beat the fire out of Ron. He fired him, and oh boy, he treated him bad. The hot dog, and I don't know, man. I'm wondering, Ron, why he didn't tear into you. What do you think, Jimmy?
Well, man, he surely had a little hate there, but I had to go along with Ron on that, man. I wanted to fire him too.
Yeah,
I thought that was another time. As soon as he come out, I'd warp your head off, Holt. I was like, no, this ain't going to get it, man.
So, yeah, we've spent a lot of time talking about him, and the fans around the country, they wanted to know the big scoop on Big Jim. And we're about at the time frame here. In fact, the last studcast I did, number 99, I was making a presentation to Channel 10 in Knoxville to move television stations from the old one up on the hill there, Sharp's Ridge, that you couldn't even get to the biggest station in Knoxville that had that signal, was going to put us almost into Lexington, Kentucky. And Big Jim is about to come to the end of the road here. We'll discuss that probably in 101, Studcast 101, about Big Jim getting the news about what's going to happen for his future. But I wanted to get y'all's opinion about whether y'all felt the same about him as I did. And I just never, once I heard the warp your head off hold, and then I saw the way he handled in most of his interviews, especially with Ron Wright. It seemed like it was the Ron Wright and Big Jim Hess show. And there wasn't anybody else on there that meant anything or was important. And I just couldn't wait to make changes to that part of that company there, for sure.
You and Robert both.
Yeah, you know, and how do y'all think that that decision and that with me being able to get on Channel 10, how did that affect everything that happened going forward from there?
You know what, Ron, we wanted to see changes, and we were glad that you had bought the beautiful city and a good part of the country as that was. And we wanted to see changes and things do well. And so we had never cared. We went over there, and you know, for me, I guess Jimmy, he didn't see Jim Hess as being too cool. And I never even gave it a second thought, because I was just going over there to work for John Cazanis. I took whoever I saw other commentators around the country that I didn't think did things right. But just went and worked for John. It was what it was. And then when we had an opportunity to do something to change it and make things better and turn it around, then, we were certainly glad that Ron made a decision to get rid of him. I'm sure you feel the same way.
I do. I thought that, you know, to move to Channel 10, you know, had a much bigger audience. And, of course, you had Les Thatcher as a commentator and Phil Rainey and other guys. It was, you know, became a much better first-class show compared to what it was. And so I thought it was a thing to do, too, man.
Well, it worked out good. It certainly worked out good for all of us. And, it was probably the right decision to make. And I was figuring out, you know, I never realized, but Big Jim Hess actually worked for that television station up on Sharp's Ridge. And he was a salesperson. He was a sports guy. He did everything on that station. And my relationship with him was very poor. And I felt like that if I tried to get rid of him, that he was going to get rid of me. He was going to get rid of my television program, and we'd have no television. And I think that's what pushed me to try to do something with Channel 10. But, what are some of the favorite? Yeah, go ahead, Jimmy.
I was going to say nothing against Jim Hess, but business is business, man. You know, yeah. You got to do what you got to do.
Yeah, and we were trying to build a business. I was trying to build a business based upon Gordon Solie. I haven't spent 4 years in Florida. My first 4 years, basically, in the business, I got to see the best, and I wanted to have the best television program I could have. And in order for it to become as big as it became, I think we had to make that move. So, you know, what are some of you guys' favorite angles that we did there in Knoxville? We did so many angles. You know, I remember, Jimmy, you turning heel against Dad. Against my dad, and then me and Rob, and you were really over as a baby face. It was the last thing people expected. And I even remember an angle that we worked on a finish that you were wrestling partners with Tora Tanaka and Professor and Fuji. And that they grabbed Dad by at the end of that match, you turned heel, and then at the end of the match, they did something with Dad that I never saw done before. And when he told me he was going to do it, I was very concerned about it. I said, no, you can't do that. You'll get hurt. And rather than jumping off on somebody that's laying on the mat, which is one thing, they held him up in the air. They took his legs. Tanaka held his legs and Fuji held his upper body. And they held him about 3 or 4 feet off the mat, and you jumped off the top rope and went down on top of him at about a 4 foot drop. And wow, I remember watching that bump thinking, oh my God. And Dad already had a bad back, but he was always willing to do more than what he should have. And that had to be an experience for you, that whole match and that whole angle.
Yeah, I was really nervous. You know, because I knew the fans was going to be shocked that I could be such an asshole after being, you know, trying to be somebody all that time. And I was partners with somebody else, and your daddy was managing us. We was against Fuji and Tanaka. And Gorgeous George had money, kept trying to buy me off, and I finally turned on my partner and your dad. And me and Tanaka held your dad up by the legs and by the waist, one of us, where he was face up, and it was Fuji did the swan dive off the top rope on it. Looked great. And your dad was always gonna, he'd do anything. Hard way, it didn't matter. You know, if it's for the business, he'd do it. Boy, and it looked great, got over great, and the pants, it's just like I figured it was gonna happen. They was good and pissed off at Jimmy Golden.
Yeah. You know, not only did that angle turn you heel and make you instant success in that regard in Knoxville, but it also helped me and the other people involved in that match as becoming a better babyface for that area. That when you do angles like that, Dad was always game for a hard way, and he always wanted things to really look really, really good, and from busting your eye and putting stitches in your head to jumping off the top rope on you in a terrible situation. And you know, he was, any time that we had an opportunity to utilize Dad, and we used him a lot that way, to try to push some angle like that and turn somebody like we turned you. And I know you and I, then we were the biggest tag team in that area. And, you know, for you to turn on me and to turn on Dad, and that was a real awful situation. And, you know, we'd be a little bit worried about you getting out of the house after that. We said, heck, we better have pretty good police to escort you back to the dressing room. And that set you afire, man. That's part of the reason that things caught on like they did in that area.
Well, you know, that was right during the war, and it was something that we needed to keep things hot. And you should have seen them, Brian. The next day we had TV. Robert and Ron was out there at the first thing. They was fighting each other to see which one's going to get me first. And they finally decided that Robert would get me that night in Harlan, Kentucky, and Ron would get me the following Friday in Knoxville if I was still alive. So we got up to Harlan, Kentucky, man, and me and Robert went round and round. Norvell Austin ended up coming into the ring. We put the boots to him, and we rolled out of the ring when the troops got there to save him. And first thing that happened, some guy picked up a chair and folded it and throwed it like a flying saucer straight at my face. And I just barely got my hand up in time to stop it, or it had knocked all my teeth out. So I looked at Norvell and said, "It's time to go, baby."
It was a lot of it was like that a lot in Harlan. It was time to go a lot of times in the dangerous place.
Yeah, we did the match in Knoxville I wrestled Jimmy Hare versus Hare deal, and I shaved my head in Knoxville. The two of them got together and give me the big screw job. And people there were screaming to me, "Don't give them the hair. Don't do it." You know, normally people, a hair match, and then whoever loses, whether it's the good guy or the bad guy, they want to get their money's worth. I mean, you said you'd shave your head, so shave it. And the people were screaming in Knoxville to me, "Don't do it. Don't do it. Don't give it to them. Just back off and say, I ain't going to do it." And they would have been just fine with it. But I decided to go ahead and let it happen and get my hair shaved and give the people that, regardless of whether they were wanting it or not. And I know, boy, you had a lot of heat from that, and you and Norvell. And we took that thing right on down later on to Alabama and fired up Mobile, Alabama with the same doggone thing that Jimmy Turnin was a big deal.
You know, and since we talked about this a little bit, and you're mentioning that, Rob, about I remember one of the things I remember is, and it's about the same time frame in 1975, and I've already turned babyface in Memphis, and I'm thinking about doing it in Knoxville at this point, and I'd put up my mustache against Ron Wright's mustache and hair. I believe he had to put his hair up, too.
He didn't have any hair.
He didn't have hair anyway, so it wasn't much he could have cost him there hair wise. But anyway, I ended up losing the match, and then I refused to cut my mustache. And I remember we sent in baby faces one after another to come to the ring that were going to beat the heck out of me and then hold me till they cut my mustache off. And I kept grabbing them and throwing them over the top rope, and another one would come, and another one, until they ran out of guys. And then Rob came down, and he hadn't been there very long at that point. And I didn't grab him, obviously, and throw him out of the ring. We kind of
couldn't have done it.
We argued back and forth, and then Rob, I finally sat down in a chair, and Rob said, "You know, you got to do it," and on the microphone and all damn deal, and I finally let him cut my mustache. It was kind of the beginning of my starting to turn babyface there in Knoxville. But we'd always did some nice little angles that really, really helped get that business really off the ground. And I really appreciate you guys, not just being here today, but for all the things y'all did back in those days and all the blood that we all spilled to make that territory such a huge success as it turned out to be.
Yeah, we learned from back in the day that we give up a lot of blood, try to make that thing work, and never minded it 1 ounce. I know I didn't.
So yeah. You mentioned it, Jimmy, about the Knoxville War, and That's been a topic here lately that really just been an amazing, man. Once we did Super Stud Cast number 13 on the Knoxville War, we saw somehow the Plan B video surfaced that the five guys had done, basically out in the business, breaking kayfabe. I mean, it was a tremendously disappointing and a tough time to be a wrestler in Knoxville. I don't think it made any difference which side of that war you were on. I think we all got to see a town being destroyed and a territory being destroyed, and it was tough being a part of.
Yeah, you know, it brought a lot of real into the situation, and you know, you can call wrestling business what you want to call it. But at that time, it became real that that we were fighting for something, and it was more than just to try to sell a house out, bring the people in, give them a good show, that that there was a feeling there of you might be in a fight tonight, anything might happen, you might go to the show and get your bag out of the car and be ready to go inside, and you may have these guys standing outside ready to take you on, and you know, you're going to the show with a feeling that, you know, if they're there, then it's going to be a real bad night for them. And it went further than just your normal wrestling shows that you go to. It was a different type of feeling that you had, and I know you felt the same way, Jimmy. We took it with us every night because we never knew what we was going to run into. And I don't know how you felt about it, or I think I do know how you felt about it, that we were ready to take on any challenge, and if there was going to be a fight, then we were going to get the best end of it.
Yes. As a matter of fact, you know, I had a match with Dick Slater in Knoxville, and Bob Root and Bob Orton Jr. showed up at our show. Of course, you know what they were saying, and they were sitting in front row. I thought they was going to come in the ring, and I'm thinking, man, what's going to happen? When they come in the ring, there's going to be a shoot here, brother, and somebody's going to get hurt. And Dick Slater's laying there and holding me in a headlock, and he's cussing him. He is telling him, get your ass on up in here. You come down here to beat one of us up. Come on up in here and do it. And I'm going, Dickie, what are you doing, man?
Yeah.
And
yeah.
He didn't pay no attention to me. He tell him, come on. So we ended up, we had to finish on the match. As soon as that was finished, was there, he slid right out of the ring and went right over there to him, man. And the crowd swamped him. And I did what I was told with Dick, daring him to stand up, and nobody stood up.
Yeah, you know, when that happened, there was an old bar downtown we'd go to after the matches on Friday night there in Knoxville called Intersection Lounge, and we'd go hang out there a little bit. So those boys were down there as well as us, and Roop and Dickie had a little conversation sort of like that, where Dick really called him out, and he had to back off because Dick, be honest with you, he's one of the guys in the business that could knock your head completely off your shoulders, and everybody knew that. Bobby had learned that the hard way down here in Florida years before, that you didn't mess around with Dick, and we were darn glad to have him on our team. Because you never knew what you was going to run into, and you knew that if you run into a problem like that, that's being in the foxhole, man. When here comes the fellas on the other side, somebody's going down hard, and you felt very comfortable in the foxhole with Dick, didn't you?
Oh yeah, absolutely. Yeah, Dick was one of the true badasses.
Yeah, God, I miss him. Yeah. I miss him today so much. Doggone it, what a heck of a guy.
Yeah, I miss him too. I mean, he was a great guy. And, you know, I was there the night that I saw him do it to Orton Jr. And it was the first time I saw the head flushing in the toilet. I got to see it a couple more times during my career. But that night was like, that was a moment for me. I like, you know, one thing, knock him out. But when you drag him through the toilet, into the toilet and shove his head in the commode and flush it. I mean, that's taking it to a whole new level. So, you know, it was a bad time frame, and, you know, it was really difficult time for all of us. And gosh, watching what happened to the territory and houses going down and where it was all headed, it just, it was really sad. After we had worked our butts off for many, many years to build something that was really spectacular and considered by most to be the best small wrestling territory in NWA history, and to watch it all go down.
Guys, this is a great point to jump in and take a quick break, and let's hear this word about the latest Super Studcast, Super Studcast number 18, part 1, with the one-man gang, Ronnie Garvin.
Hey, everybody, it's David Summers, and I'd like to take just a moment here on Studcast number 100 to thank all Studcast and Super Studcast fans who support our efforts to bring you the finest in wrestling podcast. We hope you're enjoying this special Studcast, and I just want to remind everyone of the historic Super Studcast number 18 with Fist of Stone, Ronnie Garvin, at tnstud.com or patreon.com/studcast. Now, part one has been another record breaker, and part two, out next Tuesday, is highly anticipated because fans will have their first ever opportunity to hear from both sides of the conflict about the disastrous 1979 Knoxville War. The Stud and Ronnie Garvin recall one of wrestling's greatest wars from 40 years ago, why and how it happened, the shocking Plan B video, and much more at tnstud.com or patreon.com/studcast. Only $2.99 for three fantastic hours of classic old school wrestling history from the man who lived it, your Tennessee Stud.
There you hear it, Super Studcast number 18, part one with Ronnie Garvin, available right now at tnstud.com or patreon.com/studcast. Part two is coming next week with the Knoxville Wrestling War. You will all want to hear this, but on the topic of Ronnie Garvin, let me ask you guys a question here. What was it like for you guys when you were in the same locker room with Ronnie Garvin again years after the Knoxville War? Like Smoky Mountain Wrestling, you guys were all there at the same time. Was it at all weird? Do you let bygones be bygones? What are you guys thinking when you run into him again after all those years?
You know, I'll take that first on, Brian. Ronnie Garvin, I had a ton of respect for that as a young guy starting in this business, that I worked with him an awful lot down in Florida, and he brought me around. He taught me to how to be a star in this business. He guided matches in ways that very few guys can do as well as he does. And you were so fortunate to be working with him. And when I went into Knoxville to take the book for Ron, I was glad to see him there. And he had some problems with interviews and different things. That's why Ron had Big Bad John with him at that time as a manager. But I was able to help Ronnie in developing his interview. And that with that, he really went to big stardom for us. And that a lot of our success, a tremendous amount of our success, my success as a booker there and Ron's success as an owner, came from Ronnie Garvin, that he was a spectacular talent and we were so lucky to have him. And so I felt really bad about Ronnie being on the other side and being partnered up with these guys that were going against Ron. And but later on, he had no problem saying that, you know what? I don't know what happened. I don't know what the deal. But it always went back to the thing of, gosh, dog, hugging necks. And, man, gosh, you know, it was so great to work with you. And you did so good in my career, teaching me and doing things. And so when I went into work for Smoky Mountain, I saw Ronnie. And right away, he said, hey, man, God, dog, you son of a gun. And he's right over and he's hugging necks, and there's just no way to keep that hard feeling going. And I have that today. I see Ronnie today, and we have so many stories and so much history in this business that I have to be honest. I'm sitting here next to Ron, and I know sometimes, you know, he sees these people he has some hard feelings still with. But I, as a booker and using these boys that had worked well for me, and then things went bad and they did some real bad stuff. But now, you know, I've known them, most of them, for 40 years anyway. And when I have an opportunity to do an autograph show or something, and I bump into Bob Orton Jr. Or particularly Ronnie or some of these guys that were involved in that, I just kind of put it back in the back of my mind and say, boy, there's just too much history here, and we don't have any problem shaking hands and being friends again and going on with our life, to realize that, you know, like the good Lord says, you know, you got to drop it sometime, forget it. And being I didn't own the territory, it didn't cost me the money it cost Ron. It made booking harder, made my job harder. But like I said, I didn't own the territory itself. I was just booking there. And so that was my feelings. How about you, Jim?
Well, the same thing, Robert. The first time I saw Ronnie after all that, he was like, man, I wished it had never happened. He was regretful that it all went down. But like you said about Ronnie, Ronnie was a great leader in the ring. I had some of my best matches with Ronnie. You better be ready to go though, buddy, because he'd eat you up if you didn't. So Garvin was well trained, like a lot of them Canadian boys. You know, he knew the ropes, man.
Yeah, you know, Jimmy, I'm sitting here with Ron. He'd probably have differences with me saying this, but last week I went with the boys that I managed, the Dirty Blondes, to a Legend lunch on Friday down here in Tampa. And Bob Roop was there. And I don't have the fondest feelings in the world for Bob Roop. Certainly, I didn't work with him like Ronnie Garvin and Bobby and some of these other guys. But I'll be doggone, man. He sees me across the thing, sitting, and gosh, dog, here he comes. And, oh, God, I didn't know you'd be here. Oh, son of a gun. You would think that we were dadgum of the same fathers, different mothers or something. Oh, man, gosh, dog, it's so good to see you and all the stuff. And you have a hard time holding grudges and feeling bad with things, you know, when you're somebody's receptive to you like that. And I was like, well, gosh, dog, I don't know how Ron would feel if he was here seeing you hugging necks with Bob Roop, but it, you know, it's just, you got to let bygones be bygones sometimes and just suck it up and go on with life.
Well, that's kind of, you know, guys, I'm getting a lot of questions from fans out there, you know, they're asking the same question as Brian is, basically, you know, how are you doing this? Why would you do this? But at the same time, I really believe that the good Lord wants us to forgive. And I believe that's what we need to do. I started same as you guys. I started in Florida. Ronnie Garvin was there. I mean, I not just worked with Ronnie Garvin. I was married to Ronnie Garvin for the first year I was there. We worked Fort Myers on Main Event every week. We worked O'Galley. We worked all the little small towns on top. And he really taught me a heck of a lot about working too. And this Super Stud Cast number 18 that's out there now with him is a. Really, it's been the first part was a pleasure. The second part is going to be specifically about the war. And I look for that to be a little bit difficult to go through. But at the same time, I feel like that I owe it to myself and to those that know me to forgive. And I'd do the same thing for Bob Roop. Rob keeps talking about Bobby, and for people that may not know, he's talking about Bob Orton Jr., who was one of the Knoxville Five and a great worker there too, that had been there for a couple of years. And it's a sad thing. A wrestling war is not a pretty thing, and it's never good. But that one just happened to be more destructive, and devastating than probably any wrestling war that I can think of, because it actually killed a territory.
The guys were over that, the five you're talking about, that as a booker, that I had those guys fiery hot. And I mean, it was really extra bad because you had put so much time in getting these guys to such a high level. And then for them to do something like that, then it was, it hurt a lot more than what you'd normally have in a situation like that.
Were you guys surprised that Ron Wright was so disgruntled that he participated in it?
You know, personally, I was very surprised. I was blown away because we had treated Ron Wright like family. And he had made, I know working for John Cassandis, and Jimmy will tell you the same thing. There was no money over there that we went over there and we worked the territory because Nick sent us over there. But you know, when Ron got things going and I had the book and we were rolling, that there was a lot of money over there. And so we could get the top talent and do the business the way it ought to be done. And then there's Ron Wright. He's working same angles, same type of, he's wrestling for a living, but he's making five times the money when he goes to the show and works the show. So he ought to be thankful for that. And he ought to say, hey, I'm not just bleeding over here with Whitey Caldwell and beating one another to death for $50 a night. You know, why don't you try making $500 a night? You know, so I was surprised because we had been so good to him and brought him up to such a high echelon there for Knoxville, and that was his home, that I figured he kind of owed us something, and I was really hurt by it. Yeah.
How about you, Jim? I mean, you know, you had a long relationship with Ron too. You knew him very well too.
And I have to agree with Robert on that, you know, it was shocking, surprising that Ron would do that. But, you know, after I got to thinking about it, I get to looking at that and I think, well, you know, Ron probably told them they's mad about something, so they was going to pull off. But I can see Ron saying, well, I know where TV station's at that we can get on if we want to do opposition. And I got a wrestling ring and I know this one and I know that one, and I can set us right up. Now, I don't know. That's just my opinion. That may be wrong, but
I think shocking. I think there's a lot of truth to that, man. In fact, they went back to the old television station, and guess who got the commentator job again?
Old Jim.
Big Jim Hess.
Yeah.
So, you know, they just went back. They went back and just tried to redo what had been that hadn't been a real great success in the past. They tried to go right back to it. And I'm kind of thankful that they didn't find themselves a better television station and they didn't get them a better commentator, because it might have been a little different outcome there in Knoxville. But, you know, Ron was a good guy too, though. You know, I wish I'd had the opportunity before he died to tell him, you know, that I didn't have a problem with it. And I don't anymore. I think pretty much all that's in the past. And that's why I kind of look forward to finishing up the Ronnie Garvin number 18, because it's going to be able to finally get this off my chest. And that's always a good thing, Brian, right? I mean, you know, it's a pretty big load to carry if you want to try to carry that hatred for a lifetime, it's just not good for you.
No, you certainly lost a lot losing Knoxville, but you did have a great time in Pensacola.
Oh, yeah. It's not like we left there and went to a spot that didn't have any potential. We actually left a one-city territory to go to a six-city territory that had phenomenal potential.
Yeah, you know, Brian, a lot of people don't know, but we went back to Knoxville after the war and after that stuff. And after a while, we just cooled it off and we let it go. And then we built our crew down in Continental down and we went back with Wendell Cooley and some of the people that they hadn't seen there in Knoxville. And we had tremendous success. I mean, we sold out every show in the Civic Center. That we were on fire in Knoxville. So I don't know if Ron's had a podcast which he's told people that, but we did. We had some great houses, and we really had a lot of success in Knoxville after the war. For a short time there before we closed up in Continental, we did very well in Knoxville.
Yeah, it was actually 6 years later. I mean, it took that long for them to forget and to be able, I think, to go. I don't believe if we'd have gone back there 2 years later that we'd have been able to have that success. But by waiting until they forgot about the war, a lot of people had forgotten about the war. And when we went back, it was like a big homecoming. It was phenomenal to go in that first night and see that sellout. It was like vindication almost for me, you know, like, well, we still have it here. And and we did until the day we quit running it.
Who was our football player there? That
Doug Furness
was. We had him so popular. He sat on the 50-yard line making an interview for a match he had coming up with the football coach there. I forget the football coach's name. He was one of the greatest. Jimmy, do you remember the football coach?
I'm not sure who the coach was. Johnny Majors or
that's it. Yeah, Johnny Majors. Johnny Majors. He sat there on the 50-yard line there in Neyland Stadium and made an interview for a match coming up that working with Sid Vicious as Lord Humongous. And we had a massive sellout. I mean, you couldn't hold all the people in the Civic Center that there were some great days there, that new talent of Furness and Wendell Cooley and
Adrian Street
and some of the people we came in with, they were just overnight successes in Knoxville. And then coming back with this older crew that the people were used to seeing and they loved so much. And boy, we just set that boy afire again. So, yeah, it was great days.
I remember a match with Doug Furness. If you probably remember it, Robert was in the Thunderdome, me and Furness in Knoxville had the cage set up and four poles. And at the top of them poles was a bag with the gimmick in it. And you had to guess which one of them had the gimmick.
Get the
brass knuckles out of the right bag and you can knock the other guy out.
Yeah.
Had a heck of a match with Furness. And that wasn't easy to do at that time now.
No, he was a little green, wasn't he? Yeah,
it was, but like you said, he was over, you know, because he was the first guy to ever squat with 1,000 pounds.
Yeah. Oh heck, yeah. He had those his thighs had to be 45 inches around or something. His thighs were just massive. I remember Furness. The thing I remember Furness about is a match with the Stomper, and in the match, the finish of the match. Stomper ends up on the floor and Furness goes to the far side of the ring and hits the ropes and dives over the top rope. And Archie doesn't catch him. And he hits face first on that concrete floor in the Coliseum, split him open. Oh, man.
We had no mats.
No mats. We had no mats back in those days. You didn't have any way to protect you for a bump over the top rope onto the floor. And he came down face first. I watched it. And I saw Archie back away like he either didn't remember to catch him or whatever. But, wow, what a nasty, hard way that was. I remember the blood in that one. And
near killed him.
You know, yeah, it almost killed him. I think he was probably in the hospital for a couple of days. And, you know, he was a great worker, Doug Furness. And, you know, went on to have tremendous success in Japan, a huge star in Japan. I saw something on YouTube the other day, a drop kick of Furness's that absolutely astounded me. I never saw that kind of hype. You know, Jimmy, we're always talking about those drop kicks. I saw Furness do one that was, wow, he was up there so high. It was just absolutely ridiculous. He had the drop kick down to get the guy in the face. He was above his head. So, you know, it was a tremendous talent. And just another one of those guys that we end up developing through Southeastern and through Continental. And, just a tremendous, tremendous athlete.
True. Yeah, he was. He was a good athlete, man, and he was scary. In the beginning, he scared me a few times, man. he about backdropped me over the top rope into the first or second row. I just barely caught the top rope with my fingertips enough to slow me down enough that I could catch myself on the way down. I was screaming at him in the dressing room, "Doug, for crying out loud, man, don't kill me out there, man."
Oh, yeah. There's something else. Well, Brian, how are we doing, my man?
What was it like returning to Knoxville with Smoky Mountain Wrestling, though? This was years after even you guys had returned. And was Knoxville the same as it had been? And I guess to open it up to a bigger question, Barnett failed in Knoxville. Flair and Mulligan failed in Knoxville. Do you think there was anything that could have been done to keep Knoxville afloat, keep it as a good running territory in between the war and when you guys returned?
You know, I'll take that one. That Jim Cornette and the boys that were behind the Smoky Mountain, they were awful good talent. Jim and I, we felt pretty fortunate to have that come up, Smoky Mountain. At that time, I was working for Ron and the hockey team as a marketing salesman, and I missed the business. And then Smoky Mountain got rolling, and they hired me and Jim to come in. We worked mostly with Rock and Roll Express and had some great matches. And Knoxville kind of just floated, kind of did so good. But the surrounding areas that they ran, they were really on fire. They sold out a lot of stuff, and they were great to work for. We kind of enjoyed it, didn't we, Jim?
Yeah, it was a place to work. I was still in home. And like I told him last time, it Smoky Mountain lasted longer than I thought it would. So, had some good boys in here. And like I said, we worked with Midnight Express, Rock and Roll Express, and had some good matches.
Yeah, you know, I got a funny story about that I'd work for Ron, and we would spend a few days up for the hockey team, and then we'd go back to Knoxville, and I had an apartment in Knoxville, and Ron had a rental car that he did a deal with, and the hockey team would change his rental car about every two or three months or something, and they expected him just to drive from Knoxville back, and he had some deal with them through the marketing. But you and I, I'd talk to Ron, and I'd say, "Hey, you mind if me and Jim use that car to go to so-and-so?" And I'd always tell you, "Hey, Jimmy, we're going to take Ronald's rental car when we go." And so he started turning them rental cars in. We'd go all the way to West Virginia, up on the top of the mountain there in West Virginia. I don't forget the town, Jimmy, but gosh, we'd drive the wheels off that son of a gun. You remember me telling you, "Hey, we'll take that dadgum car, Ron's rental car." He'd go to turn it back in, and the guy say, "Oh my gosh, how'd you get so many miles just going from Knoxville back?" But we ran all of Smoky Mountain in that rental car. You remember that?
Oh yeah, drive that rental car and run the guts out of it.
Drive the wheels off of it, man. Heck yeah, man.
Yeah, boy. Budget rental car would be real happy to hear this story, guys. I'm glad they didn't hear this many, many years ago. It would have been a problem for me, no doubt. You know. But they got a heck of a deal. We used to do that, Brian. When I had the hockey team, we did a promotion with Budget, and we gave away a car. We'd pick a fan out of the crowd each night. We did it in Nashville and in Cincinnati with both teams. Budget wanted to do it everywhere. And if you hit the puck through a little template, there was a little, they put an 8x10 piece of plywood with painted Budget on it. Down at the bottom was a little place that a puck could slide through, a little slot.
Little mouse hole.
It was very small. It was very small, but it was darn sure doable, because it actually happened in Cincinnati one night, and it was, gosh, the biggest hockey pop I've ever seen, you know, where a guy just came out of nowhere and hit it real slow, he was a golfer, I guess, and he took that hockey stick and used it like a puck, and he hit it real slow, and it slowly rolled down the ice. And the closer it got to the goal, the crowd got louder, and then they started coming up to their feet. And what a pop when that thing went through there. That guy turned a backflip, honestly, on the ice. They had to go to get him. He ran around. We opened the gates, brought the Cadillac in that he won. It was like, wow, what a promotion for Budget.
Ron did the backflip, too. He knew he had to give away the car.
Yeah. You know, the wonderful thing about those things, though, is you could insure that deal. You didn't really have to spend any money. That's crazy. If somebody won the car, it was already paid for by an insurance company that we just paid them out, and Budget paid the insurance company. So it was one of those super hockey promotions that everybody won in those type of things, and that was a great promotion. And I had one in Nashville that I drove the wheels off of myself for a year. In fact, I took my boat. I bought myself a boat at the end of the hockey season, and I took that rental car. It had a Cadillac rental car from Budget down, and had it put a trailer, like a hitch on the back of it, and I'd haul my boat to Florida to the Keys, and just drove the heck out of that Cadillac too. So Budget got a lot of miles on their automobiles, but they certainly enjoyed their promotion. That's for sure.
Ron, when Robert and Jimmy are in Smoky Mountain Wrestling and then go to WCW as Colonel Rob Parker and Bunkhouse Buck, do you ever get the itch to do anything when they're starting up in Knoxville again with Smoky Mountain? And obviously they eventually do a Night of Legends where they bring back legends. And then, of course, in WCW where they're on national TV. Do you at all think, I'd like to be a part of this, I'd like to do something? And to ask Robert and Jimmy similar question, do you ever think, hey, we'd like to get Ron involved in any of this?
Go ahead.
You know what? It's the funniest thing. I always, Jimmy will tell you, anytime that I ever had the book anywhere, I was always interested in getting Jimmy in as quickly as possible. And it wasn't because of family so much. You know, I love Jimmy and we are family, but he was a great talent. And that I kind of hid him from the world a lot because Jimmy might have been up in New York working for Vince, making four times the money and been a Hall of Famer for Vince right now. Because I always found something to do so that we could work closely together. And it was real fortunate that I was working in the office there in Turner Broadcasting when they had a Buckhouse Wars coming up, and they sent me and Ganya and Mike Graham and Tony Schiavone, and we went up to a golf course up near Augusta, and we were to brainstorm for we were going to do that show. Was a big show for them, and we were going to do 3 months of TV in a couple of days up there. And they were saying Buckhouse Wars would be good if we had somebody new for the thing. And I said, hey, why don't we get us a Bunkhouse Buck? And they all said, well, that's a heck of an idea, but who could we get? What could we do? And I said, Jimmy Golden. And everybody sitting there went, God, dog, can you get him? I said, oh, God, guys. I'm going to give Jimmy a call. We'll have Buckhouse Buck for this show. And that was a big move for us because the main man, Eric Bischoff, in WCW at that time, and he fell in love with Jimmy. Boy, he loved that Bunkhouse Buck, and we threw him in the angle with the natural Dustin Rhodes, and that thing just caught on fire, and Bischoff thought it was the best thing that we had, that he was absolutely in love with the Bunkhouse Buck angle and the fact that Jimmy did it so well, that Jimmy was perfect for that spot, and it was just wonderful that I was working in the office and we could make that stuff happen. That I always hired Jimmy's to tell you, I never had a booking job that Jimmy was the first one I called. I said, gosh, man, I can count on him. He'll be here and we'll start making money next week. Right, Jim?
Yeah, and I appreciate all them good words, man. And I appreciate that job that you got me down there. It worked out great. And, you know, Brian, you had mentioned about Ron getting the itch to come back. It was always good when Ron came back. Just seems like as much as we fought when we was kids growing up, tearing down the basketball goals and knocking each other out, we always worked good together because we were always interested in the business. We loved what we were doing. And Ron and Robert both, you know, they got it from their, it is in their blood, from their daddy and their grandfather, of how to run this business and things. That the talent that they had here in Knoxville was fantastic. And then we had that breakup, and you know what we all said about them guys. I love them all still today. And I just wanted to say that I don't want to go to my grave hating anybody, especially Bob Roop, Ronnie Garvin, and them boys. All that's water under the bridge now. But yeah, Ron was always good with, I'm sure he got the itch some when he saw Bunkhouse and Colonel Parker going to WCW. He wanted to get involved a little bit, didn't he, Ron?
Well, kind of, guys, but, you know, it was a little bit of a different situation. Hockey was funny for me. I'd never been around that sport, never seen a live game until I went the first time to see a minor league team in Knoxville play. But I had had such success in hockey that it was just astounding. I mean, no one had ever drawn the type of crowds that we were drawing in Nashville and Cincinnati in any type of minor league level. And so, you know, I was making some pretty darn good money in hockey, and it was easy compared to wrestling in a lot of ways. It was easier for me to do than handle wrestling business.
You didn't make the trips.
You know,
you didn't have to make the trips.
Yeah, I didn't have to go to the games. That's one thing. I never went to an away game. I think I went to two away games probably in my entire 5 years in hockey, but still made darn good money. But it probably bothered me more after 97, once I retired from hockey and I went to the Keys and lived, and then I saw you guys start that thing up at WCW. Then, you know, that I was not involved in hockey anymore. And there were probably days of, Brian, to answer your question, that yeah, I probably wanted to be a little bit involved. I do remember going a couple of times. I remember going to Miami because WCW was doing Miami one night. I don't think y'all were there on that one, Rob.
Yeah, we were.
You were there.
Yeah.
And Flair and Arn was there. Mm-hmm. I got to say hello to everybody. And
y'all gave me a ride down there. Yeah. I was staying at your place.
There you go. So, you know, I mean, yeah, there were times when I missed it but I had to be away from it for a while. I kind of burned out on wrestling by 1988. I was just kind of really ready to leave it and ready to do something else. But I would have probably liked to come back and been a part of that era there.
Well, you did come back and start doing some promoting a few years later. And I guess it kind of ties into that. Let me open this up to Robert and Jimmy. Do you guys have any good Terry Landell stories?
Terry Landell, good stories? I don't know, Brian, about the good story deal. To say a lot of good things about Terry, I can say this, that he used me quite a bit, and he always paid, and he always paid well. And for that, I say, hey, my brother, gosh, dog, it's good to see you. I'm sure Jimmy probably can say the same thing. I never worked a show for Terry where he said, the house is bad and I don't have any money. And none of that. That, you know, you work for Terry, you make a deal, and he pays you. And so, so in that regard, we did pretty good. And that's about the best story I can give you on him.
You know, Doug.
I have to agree with that, Brian. He always paid me. And the latest thing is I just went over last night to his house for a barbecue, saw some of the old boys. the best thing, I guess, that you could say about Terry is he decided to get out of the wrestling business.
I didn't know that, man.
You know what I miss?
That's good news for all wrestling fans.
I miss the barbecue, Jimmy. I'd have loved to have been there with you guys. Hot dog. No, that'd have been good.
Yeah, let me ask about another guy. On the recent Super Studcast with Jimmy and Ron, you guys talked about jumping Austin Idol at a service station, I believe.
Yeah.
Do you guys have any other good Austin Idol stories, and what was he like to have working for you?
You know what? Idol was, that's a good name for him. You know, it's Dennis McCord, and that's the way I always knew him as a young guy. But Austin Idol, what a great name, because he was really, really in love with himself.
He was his idol.
Oh yes, he was his idol. Yeah, he's a different kind of guy. You knew when you were around him that you were lower down the ladder than he was. He in his mind, man, he was really up there. And if the house was doing well in a sellout, it was all because of him. there was no doubt about that. We just kind of, you know, I worked with Idol on houses, and I'd always say, darn glad to be on your show, brother.
No, he was a, you know, I never had problems doing business with Austin, he was very high on himself, and we did beat the hell out of him, didn't we, Jimmy? And I think it was Red Holland's gas station. It was probably, what, a mile or less than a mile from the television studios. And somebody called and said, Austin Idol's filling up his car with gas. And we left the studio, went down there and beat the hell out of him to keep him from getting to the show. And he got there, but it was too late. I mean, he didn't get a chance to do his interview. He was all bloody, and he was all clothes all torn up, and he looked like a mess. But when they got ready, I remember the show ran out of time, and they got to the time. Austin, what happened? And he was just starting to say something, and they ran right into the end of the program. He never got to do his interview, but we surely had a good time beating the hell out of him, actually, didn't we, at the gas station?
Yeah, it worked great because it was halfway a shoot. And like Robert said, Austin Idol, he played the part real well. But let me tell you about it in 72 when I went to Australia. Austin Idol came over there. He was first starting. His name was Mike McCord, Iron Mike McCord, because he's real strong. And we were working with Dick Dunn and Don Carson. And he was tatering the hell out of Carson to Dunn. They wouldn't work with him. They'd make me look like $1 million, and they would, as soon as Idol come in, they'd slide out onto the floor. They told me, said, you're going to look great, but said, we can't do nothing with him, man.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, boy. There's some real characters around. Austin is one of those guys that's a little different, for sure.
Yeah, that he was one of those talents that could draw you a lot of money, but you had to be concerned about how your match would turn out. That, you know, you people go buy the ticket, come to the show, you got a sellout house, and if you're a booker that's booking him, you're sitting back there eating off your fingernails saying, boy, I hope I can pull this deal off, because he wouldn't give you that match sometime that you needed to make your people happy.
So, you know, when he was working for us with Continental in the Continental days, God, we were so loaded with talent that, you know, there was a lot of times when he wanted to be on top and felt like that he was the top guy. But he never was in that position very often. And he never complained. He never complained to me about it.
He liked Pensacola.
You know, he just loved the fact he was making big money anyway, you know, and he loved the town he was living in and the beach and being where he was. And that atmosphere that was always there with Southeastern and in those Continental dressing rooms of where everybody was having a party, it was just like it was a wonderful place to be. And he was smart enough to not rock that boat too much. Because he liked the way it was floating. It was a pretty nice place for him to be.
Yeah.
He he was making a fortune off the gimmicks.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. And he still is today.
He always by himself.
Yeah, and he still is today, making a fortune off the gimmicks.
Yeah, he was over. He was over good, and like you said, we made some good money with Idol at and certain spots there, and you know, he was all right.
What about Dr. Tom Pritchard?
Tom, I'll take that up, man. When Tom came in to work for us, I was booking, and he started in Birmingham. And Tom was a type of fella that didn't feel comfortable a lot around the people, particularly bosses and people like that. And he didn't know me at all. And he worked the show, and we were riding back to Pensacola, and it's a 250-mile ride from Birmingham. And we stopped at a store, a little 7-Eleven we all stopped at, and get some beer. And I was the boss, and I told Tommy, I said, I'll ride home with you. And he was like, oh, no, you don't want to ride with me. He said, I've had a lot of wrecks. And I said, oh, no kidding. He said, and my car's, it's old. It's not very good. Thing. I said, that's all right. I said, we'll just take it easy and drive. We won't have to run too fast with it. And we'll have a little smoke, and we'll have a beer, and we'll ride on in. They say, oh, God, no. But I said, no, I'm gonna ride with you. I was riding with Jerry Stubbs or somebody else, and I said, well, I'm going to ride with this new boy and go in. So when we talk today, Tommy tells me, he says, oh, God, you scared me to death that night. But having to ride 250 miles with the boss, I knew I was going to say something bad, but he realized by the time he got to Pensacola that he was with me. And it wasn't like being with the boss. that I like to ride down the road, you know, I'm not driving, so I'll drink a few beers with you, buddy, and ag you on a little bit to have some brewski, and we're going to have a nice trip, a lot of fun, get to know one another. And not one of those old-time stories of the old-time promoter that's going to conjure up a lot of bad feelings about you because of something you said or something. I fell in love with Tommy the first time that we made that trip, and I said, this boy's going to be big business for me. And man, he was. And he really came around. He came to really, he'll tell you, he really came to know himself, find himself working for us. He got a lot of respect for himself and his talent that he had. He wrote a book, and he signed the book to me. So nice of giving him such a break and teaching him that his self-worth, that there was a lot in that guy, man. He was just a fantastic piece of talent, and he didn't even know it. And today, I think he does.
I think, Brian, good simple way to put it is I think we changed Dr. Tom's life for him when he came to us in Birmingham and back in the day. And we really made a different man out of him. And I think he would give us credit for that. You know,
he signed his book. He signed his book. Thanks, Rob, for making me a doctor. Thanks for making me. Because now every place he goes, everybody calls him Doc. Right, Jimmy?
Yeah. He said, I never had a boss like this.
Yeah. He became a doctor. Isn't that something? Gosh, dog, man. Oh, what a business.
Well, guys, I don't know where we are, Brian, but, you know, I think we're probably getting pretty close. And
yeah,
I just want to thank these guys. I mean, obviously, and the fans, for being here and being a part of it. And we don't normally do these hour and a half. This has been a different type of stud cast. And I hope everybody's enjoyed it. And I just want you two guys to know I really appreciate y'all doing this. And in your case, Rob, I might say this is the last time I'll ask you because you're always.
I cost you too much. You know what would have happened, Jimmy? If I'd have stayed here another 10 minutes, he'd have been on time and a half.
Oh, yeah.
That buddy, it would have been big money. So he's going to close off. Yeah.
Hey, boy. Well, Brian. Just great guys. Thank y'all very much, Jimmy, Rob, both y'all for being here and making this a special program. And I'm looking forward to doing number 101 next week. And thank y'all very much.
Yeah.
Hey, I love you guys. Y'all come see me when you can.
All right, we will, man. You keep things smooth up there in the Smokies, man. Keep it nice. I'm sure you have a beautiful day. So
come see us, man.
All right.
Well, Ron, this has certainly been a most memorable episode of the Studcast. Of course, the first 90-minute episode, as well as the first one to have two guests on the line at the same time, very much like the Super Studcast. And on that topic, we want to remind everyone to become a patron of the show. For only $2.99 a month, you get in the door. It's the best deal in wrestling. And you get to hear all of the Super Studcast, all of the rest of the stories. You get to hear the Tennessee Stud talk about Andre the Giant, the Knoxville Wrestling War, the Georgia Wrestling War, Ron Wright. Get to hear conversations with Terry Funk, Stan Hansen, Robert Fuller, Jimmy Golden, Ronnie Garvin, and so much more. TNStud.com or Patreon.com/Studcast. Super Studcast number 18, part 2, is released on Tuesday, June 25th, all about the Knoxville Wrestling War and more. So check that out right now. We want to remind you, you can become friends with the Tennessee Stud on Facebook. Just look for Ron Fuller, the Tennessee Stud. You can also follow the Stud on Instagram and Twitter at Ron Fuller Welch. You can follow me on Twitter at Great Brian Last, and you can hear me on the 605 Super Podcast at 605pod.com or available wherever it is that you find your favorite podcasts, classic wrestling talk, and wrestling humor, the 605 Super Podcast. Also want to remind you, you can follow the Arcadian Vanguard Podcast Network on Twitter at Super Podcast. Ron, this has been a spectacular episode, but where are we going next week?
Well, next week, we're going to return to Knoxville. Obviously, we're going to get back at it. We're going to right back into the Studcast. We're going to talk Knoxville and Memphis in May of 1975. We're going to get the answer from the big Knoxville television station proposal that I did in episode number 99. We're going to take our first airplane flight with Ron and Don Wright. That's an experience and a great story in itself. We're going to discuss how the big Jim Hess problem will finally be solved. And we're going to head into Southeastern Wrestling's first summer of operation. Got a lot going on. We're right back into the Studcast. We're in 1975. We're going to be in May, and I can't wait for it.
Ron Fuller's Studcast is a production of the Arcadian Vanguard Podcast Network. For the Tennessee Stud Ron Fuller, for Robert Fuller, and for Jimmy Golden, I'm the Great Brian Last. The story continues next week.
Thanks for joining us today for this historic Studcast. The true story continues next week. So full Nelson your friends and point them in our direction for another ride with the Tennessee Stud.
1, 2, 3.
This is David Summers saying so long from the Great Smoky Mountains.